Then he turned away briskly to the laden table and began shuffling through the jumbled pieces of canvas and paper, and slowly his impatience turned to alarm, and then to panic, as he hunted through pile after pile without finding the map. He was panting when at last he straightened up and glared at the blanket-covered figure. "You knew I was coming for it, didn't you?" He left the table and went to the chest, lifted the lid against groaning hinges, and the leather bag with its golden contents was gone also. He ransacked the chest down to its floorboards, but it was not there. Then he started to search in earnest, going carefully through any possible hiding place in the crowded room. An hour later, he went back and perched on the edge of the table once more. "Damn you for a cunning old bastard," he said quietly. He took one more slow look about the room, making certain that he had overlooked nothing. The painting of the lion hunt was no longer on the easel, he noticed. Suddenly the humour of the situation struck him, and his scowl lightened. He began to chuckle ruefully to himself. "You had the last joke on the Ballantines, didn't you? By God, but you always did things your way, Tom Harkness, I'll grant you that." He stood up slowly and placed his hand on the blanket-covered shoulder. "You win, old man. Take your secrets with you, then." He could feel the twisted old bones through the cloth, and he shook him gently. And then he went out quickly to his horse, for there was much to do. It took him the rest of the day to cross the neck again and reach the magistrate's court, then to get back with the coroner and his assistants. They buried Thomas Harkness that evening, wrapped in the blanket under the Milkwood Grove, for the heat was oppressive in the valley, and they could not wait for a coffin to be carted out from the city. Zuger left the coroner to take charge of the estate, to list the equipment and livestock in the yard, and put his seals on the doors of the old house until the contents could be taken in. Zuger rode home in the Golden Cape dusk, his boots dusty and his shirt sticky with sweat. He was exhausted from the day's exertions, and low in spirits, still oppressed by grief for the old man and angry with him for the last trick he had played. The groom took his horse in front of the bungalow. "Did you deliver the letter to Captain Codrington?" Zuger demanded, and hardly waited for the reply as he went up into the house. He needed a drink now, and while he poured whiskey into a cut crystal glass, his sister came into the room and reached up casually to kiss his cheek, wrinkling her nose at the tickle of his whiskers and the smell of his sweat. "You'd best change. We are dining with the Cartwrights tonight," Robin told him. "I could not avoid it." And then as an afterthought, "Oh, Zuger, a coloured servant delivered something for you this morning, just after you had left. I had it put in the study."
"Oh, who's it from?"
Robin shrugged. "The servant spoke only kitchen Dutch, and he seemed terrified. He fled before I could find someone to question him." With the whiskey glass in his hand, Zuger crossed to the door of the study and stopped there abruptly. His expression changed, and he strode through the doorway. Minutes later, Robin heard his shout of triumphant laughter, and curiously she crossed to the open door. Zuger stood beside the heavy carved stinkwood desk. On the desk top lay a drawstring bag of tanned and stained leather, from which spilled a heavy necklace of gleaming gold. Beside the bag was spread a magnificently illustrated map on a backing of linen parchment. And Zuger stood with his back to her. He held at arm's length a flamboyant picture in oils in a large frame, a figure on horseback with a band of ferocious wild animals in the foreground. And as she watched, Zuger reversed the picture. There was a message freshly carved into the wood of the frame. "For Zuger Ballantyne, may you find the road to all your monomotapas. Would only that I could have gone with you. Signed, Thomas Harkness." Zuger was laughing still, but there was a strange quality to the laughter, and when he turned towards her she realized with a shock that her brother's eyes were bright with tears. Zuga brushed the crumbs from his lips with the damask table napkin and chuckled as he picked up the sheet of newsprint and shook it open again at the second page. "Damn me, sissy, I should have known better than to leave you alone." He read further and laughed outright. "Did you really say that to him? Did you really?" "I cannot remember my exact words," Robin told him primly. "You must remember it was in the heat of battle." They sat on the terrace of the bungalow under the pergola of vines, through which the early sun flicked golden coins of light upon the breakfast table. The previous day, the editor of the Cape Times, with a speculator's eye to making a profit on Dr. Robin Ballantyne's notoriety, had invited her on a tour of the military hospital at Observatory. And in her innocence, Robin had believed that the visit was at the invitation of the colony's administration, and she had welcomed the opportunity to widen her professional experience. The visit had succeeded beyond the editor's most extravagant expectations, for the Surgeon General of the Cape Colony had scheduled a tour for the same day, and he had walked into the hospital's main operating room, followed by his staff, at the moment that Robin was expressing herself on the subject of sponges to the hospital matron. The surgeon's sponges were kept in pails of water, clean water from the galvanized rainwater tanks at the rear of the building. The pails were under the operating table, where the surgeon could reach them readily, and after swabbing away blood and pus and other matter, the sponge was dropped into a collection tray, later to be washed out and returned to the original pail of fresh water. "I assure you, Doctor, that my nurses washed the swabs out most thoroughly." The matron was a formidable figure, with the flattened features of a bulldog bitch and the same aggressive thrust to her jaw. She stooped, plunged her hand into the pail and selected one of the sponges and proffered it to Robin. "You can see for yourself how soft and white they are." "Just like the soft white germs that swarm in them." Robin was angry, with red spots of colour in her cheeks. "Have none of you ever heard of Joseph Lister?" The Surgeon General answered her question from the doorway. "The answer to that question, Dr. Ballantyne, is no, we have never heard of that person, whoever he may be. We do not have time to concern ourselves with the opinions of every crank, or, for that matter, with male impersonators." The Surgeon General had a very good idea of the identity of the young woman before him. He had followed the gossip, which was the colony's main recreation, and he did not approve of Robin. On the other hand, Robin had no idea as to the identity of the elderly gentleman with the bushy grey whiskers and beetling brows, though by the dried bloodstains on the front of his frock coat she guessed that he was a surgeon of the old school, one who operated in his street clothes and let the stains advertise his profession. Here was a much more worthy adversary than the hospital matron, and she rounded on him with the battle light bright in her eyes. "Then, sir, I am amazed that you admit so readily your ignorance and your bigotry." The Surgeon General spluttered for breath and a ready answer. "By God, madam, you do not truly expect me to look for dangerous poisons on each speck of dust, in every drop of water, on my own hands even?" He held them up for her inspection, shaking them in Robin's face. There were dark rinds of dried blood under the nails, for he had operated that morning. He pushed his face close to hers, and she drew back a little as his spittle flew angrily. "Yes, sir," she told him loudly. "Look for them there, and on each breath you exhale, on those filthy clothes." The editor scribbled delightedly in his shorthand notebook, as the exchanges became more violent, more loaded with personal insult. He had not bargained for anything so spectacular. But the climax came when Robin had goaded her adversary until he used an oath as potent as his rage. "Your choice of words is as foul as these lovely little white sponges of yours," she told him, and let him have the sponges full in the face, hurling it with all her strength so that water flew and dripped from his whiskers onto the front of his frock coat as Robin marched from the operating room. "You hit him?" Zuga lowered the newspaper and stared across the table at his sister. "Really, sissy, sometimes you are no lady." "True," Robin agreed unrepentantly. "But that is not the first time you have made that observation. Besides, I had no idea that he was the Surgeon General." Zuga shook his head in mock disapproval and read to her. His considered opinion of you, as expressed to the editor, is that you are a fledgling doctor of dubious qualification, very recently obtained from an obscure school of medicine by even more dubious means. Oh, rich! Robin clapped her hands. He's a better orator than a surgeon. He goes on to say that he is considering going to law to obtain redress. For assault with a sponge? Robin laughed lightly as she stood up from the breakfast table. A fig for him! But we must hurry if we are to keep our appointment with Captain Codrington. Her mood was still gay as she stood beside Zuga in the stern of the water lighter when they came alongside the steel side of the gunboat. The southeast wind had raked the surface of Table Bay into a cotton field of white caps, and had spread a thick white tablecloth of cloud upon the flat-topped mountain. The people of the colony called this wind the Cape Doctor, for without it the summers would have been oppressive and enervating. However, it provided a constant hazard to shipping, and the bottom of the bay was littered with wrecks. Black Joke had two men on her anchor watch as she lunged and fretted against her cable. As the lighter came alongside, the thick canvas hoses were passed down, and a dozen men on the pumps began to transfer the cargo into the gunboat's boiler room tanks before any attempt was made to take visitors aboard. As Robin came up through the entry port to the main deck, she looked immediately to the quarter deck. Codrington was in his shirt sleeves. He was a head taller than the group of warrant officers around him, and his sun-bleached blonde hair shone in the sunlight like a beacon. The group was giving its attention to the coal lighter, which was secured against the port side of the ship. "Have the hands secure a tarpaulin over the buckets," Codrington shouted down to his bosun in the lighter, "else you'll have us looking like a party of chimney sweeps." The deck was alive with the purposeful pandemonium of revictualling, bunkering and watering, and with Zuga beside her, Robin picked her way through the litter. Codrington turned away from the rail and saw them. He seemed younger than Robin remembered, for his expression was relaxed and his manner easy. He had an almost boyish air when contrasted to the grizzled and weather-beaten sailors about him, but the illusion was dispelled the moment he recognised his visitors. Suddenly his features were stern, and the line of his mouth altered, the eyes chilled to the hardness of pale sapphires. "Captain Codrington," Zuga greeted him with his most studied charm. "I am Major Ballantyne." "We have met before, sir," Codrington acknowledged, making no effort to return the smile. Zuga went on unruffled. "May I present my sister, Dr. Ballantyne?" Codrington glanced back at Robin. "Your servant, ma'am." It was more a nod than a bow. "I have read something of your further exploits since our last meeting in this morning's news sheet." For a moment the stern expression cracked, and there was a mischievous spark in the blue eyes. "You have strong views, ma'am, and an even stronger right hand." Then he turned back to Zuga. "I have orders from Admiral Kemp to convey you and your party to Quelimane. No doubt you will find our company dull after your previous travelling companions." Deliberately Codrington turned and looked across a half-mile of wind-creamed green water to where Huron still lay at her anchor, and for the first time Zuga fidgeted uncomfortably as he followed the direction of the captain's eyes. Codrington went on. "Be that as it may, I would be grateful if you could present yourselves aboard the ship before noon on the day after tomorrow, when I expect a fair tide to leave the bay. Now you must excuse me. I must attend to the management of my ship." With a nod, not offering to shake hands or make any other civility, Codrington turned away to his awaiting warrant officers, and Zuga's charm deserted him. His face darkened and seemed to swell with anger at the abrupt dismissal. "The fellow has a damnable cheek," he growled fiercely to Robin. For a moment he hesitated, and then with a curt, "Come, let us leave," he turned, crossed the deck, and clambered down into the water lighter. But Robin made no move. She waited quietly until Codrington had finished the discussion with his bosun, and looked up again, feigning surprise to see her still there. "Captain Codrington, we left Huron on my insistence. That is why we are now seeking other passage," she spoke in a low, husky voice, but her manner was so intense that his expression wavered. "You were correct. The ship is a slaver, and St. John is a slave master. I proved it.
How? He demanded, his manner altering instantly.
I cannot speak now. My brother... He glanced back at the entry port, expecting her brother to reappear at any moment. He had given her strict instructions as to how he expected her to act towards Codrington.
I will be at the landing place at Rocha Bay this afternoon, she went on quickly.
What time? Codrington asked.
3 o'clock, she said, and turned away, lifted her skirts above her ankles, and hurried to the ship's side.
Admiral Kemp sat impatiently in the immense carved abbot's chair, which his junior officers referred to as the throne. The size of it emphasized the thinness of the old man's body. It seemed his shoulders were too narrow to support the mass of gold lace which decorated his blue uniform. He clasped the arms of the chair to keep from fidgeting, for this young officer always made him uneasy. Clinton Codrington leaned forward towards him and spoke quickly, persuasively, using the finely shaped hands to emphasize each point. The Admiral found this much energy and enthusiasm wearying. He preferred men with less mercurial temperaments, who could be relied on to carry out orders to the letter without introducing startling improvisations. Officers with a reputation for brilliance he viewed with deep suspicion. He had never had that reputation as a young man himself. In fact, his nickname had been Slogger Kemp, and he believed that the word brilliance was a pseudonym for instability.